creating things for people with autism, it's realizing some of these patterns, right? So how do you make it easy for someone dealing with people who are different than you? How do you make it easy? And how do you make it so you can't get in trouble? And how do you make it so their life can go a bit smoother? Because it's kind of unfair.
That was Kevin Gervais, founder and CTO at Touchless. Touchless is a new startup that is laser-focused on improving usability for a neurodiverse user base. On this episode, we dive into Kevin's passion for working with people on the spectrum and discuss how Touchless is paving the way towards better usability for a neurodiverse world. Welcome to this week's episode of Capital Geek. Kevin Gervais, my good buddy. How are you, my friend?
Good. Been a while.
It's been a while. I was thinking this morning, the last time we had you on the show, we had just started to talk about COVID here in North America. And nothing was locked down yet, but we were all sort of sensing the calm before the storm. You know, it reminded me of the last few hours before a hurricane hits shore. That feeling in the air you get. And we did it at the studio, right?
I was there in person. I remember when we used to do these things. It's like a distant memory. Yeah, crazy, yeah.
Whole different world, you know, from 18 months ago or so. Well, it's great to have you back on the show, and I'm really looking forward to catching up. You know, for those out there that maybe didn't catch the earlier episode, let's just give a brief introduction to sort of who you are and what you're doing, and then we'll get into sort of what you guys are doing lately and things like that.
Yeah, it's been interesting not being in the CEO chair. And so we talked a bit about that, about the journey as an entrepreneur. Actually, COVID has helped me realize even further why that was a good decision, in that I could kind of zero in on the stuff I'm super passionate about, which is data and technology. You know, I came from doing web design when I was 7, was my first client, and then ran a couple agencies, and then started Statflow. And then once it got to about, you know, 40, 50 people, realized the job changed quite a bit. Right? Like, becomes a lot of really important work, but it becomes like the focus becomes staff management, HR, creating processes, great learnings. I think the best learning out of it was learning that I wanted somebody else to do it. And I wanted to watch how it got done and learn from that and kind of shift into more of a technical role and more of a research role. So yeah, that process was super eye-opening because that was the first time I've ever gone through that type of a transition before. So I think with COVID, and now that, you know, we're working from home a lot more and we're, you know, forced to kind of just zero in on the stuff that's in front of us and that we're naturally excited about, just validated that decision.
I think there's a pretty profound difference between what it feels like when you're building something versus what it feels like when you're scaling something.
Oh, totally.
You know, and I think that this is something that a lot of founders realize. They realize that either they like to build, they like to be early, especially technical founders, we like to put our hands on things. And at some point, it becomes more about scaling than building, at least at the CEO level. And, you know, for some people, that's what they love. They love the scaling part of it. And I love that we worked in a space in the market and an industry in a time when, as you said, we can kind of focus on the things that are right in front of us and that we're naturally good at. I talked to my son yesterday. I was giving him some career advice, my oldest son. And I said, you know, at times like this, it's important to figure out what are the things that you're good at when you're not trying hard so that you can be great at them when you try hard. Because if you spend your time doing things that you have to work really hard to even be good at, you know, it's exhausting and chances are it may be very difficult for you to ever be great at it. But if you find things that you're naturally good at, usually those are things that you sort of naturally enjoy doing as well. You get a lot of joy out of it. If you get joy out of it, you tend to be good at it. And when you can lean in and put extra focus, you get, you know, exponential results.
Oh, totally. Like I think of what's happened the past year and a half. It's like a great multiplier. Whoever you were before COVID, this just makes that times 10. Meaning, like, if you are already a person that's just very content and you've got your rhythm and you've got your routine, you know, that anchor can carry you through anything. But if you don't have your stuff together, you know, this just makes it that much worse, right? Or if you're kind of in a role where you're frustrated, try doing it virtually without everybody in the same room. I think to that point about career planning, realizing that this is the time to zero in on the stuff that you're just super passionate about, find your niche, develop that, and then just live it, and just, you know, take it to 100%. And this is the time to figure that out. right? And try a bunch of things. And whoever's going to come out of this where they've learned and they've tried stuff is going to come out of the other side of this in a really good place versus the ones who just get swallowed up by the changes that have happened, which, you know, I think realistically, I got really excited after we last talked. It was like, oh yeah, I'm going to change, do a whole million things. And the reality of COVID, I think, just you kind of take a pause, right? Like your routine gets really messed up. We were in lockdown here in Toronto since November, full lockdown up until just recently. And so that really has an effect, right, on your ability to focus. And I think also it has an effect on language. And I think it's also been interesting to see what it did to companies, where now people have to rely on what's in front of them more and more, or what's available to them where everyone is remote. Yeah, they have to use what's in front of them more. I guess that's kind of the main takeaway from the last few months.
I think for me, I also noticed that in any role, there are certainly parts of the job that you enjoy more than other parts. But I think for the parts that you find especially uncomfortable or distasteful, I think doing that part of your job from home and letting the energy of that task into where you live is different than doing it at the office. And I think for me, at least, once I've kind of learned to integrate my home life and my work life, and there's really no separation anymore. I mean, it was at best a dotted line boundary before COVID. But now that we live and work in the same place 24/7, and we just try to integrate work life and home life and family life and all these things, in many cases, we integrate work not only at home, but when we're traveling and on vacation, because it's just this integrated lifestyle. I think for me, at least, it's made it to where I just really hate to bring that negative energy into my home, in my home office especially.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, if it probably is forcing us to get better at dealing with this stuff, whereas normally it would all just bent up in the office, like it would just build up in the office, right? Or maybe the discomfort, or maybe if you're doing something that you're not comfortable with, you just, that anxiousness builds up, and then you come home and then it's like unloading. Whereas working from home forces us to get back to a better headspace. It's a very good point. Probably a good time to start a company now. No, but yeah, you probably end up with more empathy for yourself and more empathy for those around you. And also your family will call you out on it. They'll be like I have a, you know, an autistic younger brother who I take care of. And that's been my latest startup amongst, you know, some of the new stuff we're up to. But that was a big change for me, having him live with me. He's in his 20s. But he's not shy to be like, hey, Kevin, I'm here.
Yeah.
You know, if you start to zone in and you start to get negative, or you start to like not want to do stuff, you know, the family is more likely to call you out on
it. I think so.
And I think it's a healthy thing for entrepreneurs, because especially with, like, I have ADHD, and you can zero in on like hyper focus on stuff so easily. Like even just last night, I was coding and doing some stuff, but it was like 1 a.m. and probably 6 hours passed by, like where I was just like in the middle of something. And then, you know, younger brother comes in and he's like, Kevin, we have to sleep. It's like, oh yes, right. I think if I didn't have that support, if I was just at the office, I would be in a much more unhealthy state.
I think, you know, for me, I used to always use my commute as a way to shift into work mode in the mornings on my way there. And on my way home, I would shift out of it. And usually for me, that meant calling my dad on, you know, while I was driving or something. And we talked. And by the time I get home, I'm in a different headspace. Like you mentioned, having family around can be a huge asset. My wife is one of those no bullshit, tell you what it's like kind of people. And so she calls me on it. If I'm over the top, if I'm super amped up, I'm still in work mode at home, you know, she calls me on my shit, which is nice. But I'll tell you, if I were living alone right now during this pandemic, I'm not sure how I would have dealt with it, because I think I'm the kind of person who probably would have, you know, been sitting in his chair for 3 days in wrinkled pajamas, still writing code or writing articles or whatever. And, you know, if there's no forcing function to have me shift in and out of that mode, I might have just stayed there.
I mean, you can still do that from time to time, but yeah, like exactly. But I think, like, yeah, there's a lot of interesting changes. Like what I've been really excited about the last year and a half is just observing what it's done to humanity. Like I'm just a big researcher. I love data. Like I'm just a huge data nerd. I would have thought, and all these articles came out, right, saying, you know, these different studies, right? For example, just a few years ago, there was a Harvard study saying only 3% of companies are happy with their data quality. That was a few years ago. So then I thought, okay, well, with the COVID, oh, for sure, that's going to just fix it, right? Like, you're going to have people just, you know, and there was, again, this flood of articles saying, this is the big shift. Oh, what's taken, you know, 10 years is now going to be done in 3. And so I had this massive sense of urgency about a whole bunch of things. And then you realize that, wow, things take forever.
Yeah, they do.
Because of the way things are built and the way the silos that exist and the fact that they can't pivot how they want to. They'd love to. But especially if you're in a mid-sized company and higher, like, your stuff is siloed. Maybe you're stuck with your existing system. Maybe they don't have APIs. And then, so what do you do, right? Like, or maybe you're in a regulated market. Like, and these are the, like, in telecom, I would have thought the telecom could just turn on a dime in certain scenarios because they are the backbone of society on so many things. And yet they just, and they have thousands of APIs and even they can't move. So imagine everybody else. And so, yeah, it was very eye-opening to see where the underlying problems are and that I would have thought just would have been solved because of, like if there was a time for folks to make changes, it's in the middle of crisis.
Yeah.
So the fact that people couldn't was really eye-opening. Because they probably would have wanted to.
That may be part of what's driving so much both employee turnover and, you know, we're setting records for new companies started, you know, right now across the globe. I forget what the data said last week. I read a report about it, but thousands and thousands of new entrepreneurs and founders getting out there. And a lot of people have said this is the time to quit their job and start their own company. I think it's easier in many cases to start anew when you have a complex system or a complex organization and build up. Because as you said, in a large organization like a telecom company, shifting is hard, turning is hard, change is hard. And in many cases, if you're an infrastructure company, you know, change is risky, especially during a crisis. And now we're...
Oh, you can't break anything.
You can't break anything.
But I would argue just on that point, I think it's risky for anyone to change. Even if you're a small business and you're relying on Shopify or some other system, it's risky even then, right? For someone to pick up and move and go in a different direction. And so I think the issue is that the way that we try and solve these things is we force people to change. We say that you have to change. You have to change your system out. You have to do these different things. And so I think the learning is that there is a hybrid way to do it. You know, and I'm still early on this thesis, but like I think this idea of where everyone has to switch out their system.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, I think, to a couple problems, right? I think first the learning is in order for people to pivot, it would require massive change. Change to the data, change to the systems, and that's why they couldn't move. So that's a broken model, right? Not so much the fact that their systems are wrong or maybe not a great fit for them, but it's the fact that we're forcing people to have to change their entire, you know, large system in order to pivot. That just seems wrong, right? And then the second thing is you have this explosion of new startups, as you mentioned, and they are starting from scratch a lot of the times. Like everyone has to design their data from the beginning and they have to go, okay, like I'm going to set up my CRM. Or something. Okay, what type of objects am I going to put in it? Do I care about relationships? Like, can a contact belong to multiple parties beyond just one account? Okay, so how does that affect system? Like, everyone has to start from scratch. And that just seems wrong because you're actually never solving the problem, right? You're going to have these startups that all kind of get excited. They start from scratch, but then at a certain point, we ran into this at Snapflow, but once you kind of get going, you get, you know, 10, 50, 100 customers. If your data model wasn't built properly at the beginning, it's really hard to change.
It's really hard.
And then even just Googling, like last night, I was looking at just different design patterns for data and just seeing that there isn't a standardization of it. It just blows my mind, right? Like, why does everybody have to keep inventing an address record or a contact record or... Like, why is everything first name, last name when you have people with like 7 names from South American countries, right? Or different countries. Like, things are not, people are building stuff quickly, not realizing that it's just actually contributing to more problems. Like, the startups of today are going to be the monoliths of tomorrow that can't move. So it's interesting, right? That we haven't actually broken that pattern yet. And we think that starting over from scratch is the solution when it, I don't think that it is, right? I think we just need better building blocks. Anyway, I know this is a bit of a tangent, but I just think the learnings of this is that we try and solve the issues of today by building a scrappy startup only for them to be, you know, a slow moving thing later when they want to pick up and move to a different system.
Yeah. Or they get acquired or they scale. Either way, they get locked into the same pattern, which is hard to escape from. You said something earlier about a startup relating to autism.
Yeah.
Let's we'll circle back to that.
Yeah, so I guess working with someone who's autistic has been a big eye-opener for me. Like, I kind of joked for a while that that was my new startup, right? Like, trying to understand how do I get up to speed with how to live in that world, right, where I have to make a bunch of accommodations.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've also noticed is that the world is not made to accommodate people with different thought patterns. And we address these issues today by adding an accessibility button on top of a website, and we think we've done our job. When really it's, you know, things are not written in a clear way.
It's deeper than that, yeah.
The buttons are not, you know, obvious. Like, you can change the font size, but if it's a confusing workflow, then you're not actually solving the problem. And so it really opened my eyes to a bunch of things, right? Is like, first, there's a lot of workflows that are not built for people with different learning styles. Second is, if you can solve for that, you help everybody else, actually. Because if you can make it easy for someone with autism to do something, you're going to make it easy for everybody else. Even just seeing the vaccine booking process of how that was done in different states and countries, you can see the ones that put accessibility front and center. And the workflow is so easy. And I just going through that process where I'm thinking, wow, like, imagine if business was this way, where it was just, even if you don't have that disability, if you design to make things easy to use, you know, you get a better outcome. So I think just realizing the gaps that exist in interfaces and workflows and even the communication for people on the spectrum was eye-opening. The second thing was realizing that a bunch of components and widgets and things that people pop into their sites are contributing to the problem.
Mm.
You know,
for example?
Well, like for example, in auto, as an example. I love looking at auto because, and you'll see some announcements, you know, in September of a group where I'm bringing some of the headless and modern web technologies that's been used in other sectors into auto. You know, a typical auto dealer website, first it takes, you know, 20 seconds to load, 15 seconds to load. Not the vendor's fault that powers it, but it's because these dealers are sometimes asked to put all these widgets on top of, like a calculator, have this button to calculate your trade-in value,
mm-hmm.
Have this button to, you know, do some function. And then it takes you into a completely different workflow, opens a pop-up, makes you re-enter your information, is jammed with a bunch of text that is not easily read. So widgets, especially if they impact the interface of a site or a web experience, can be part of the problem, right? Because they're worked on in isolation, and they're not really looked at when they're building them. They're not thinking about how does this actually all connect with all the other widgets somebody might install on their site. And so you end up with this disjointed thing and then wonder why the conversion rates are 1%. So realizing that there's components, like building, again, went back to building blocks that are not built for different learning styles, but then also just learning what it's done to communication. Like, so with autism, there's very easy to have trigger words. And if you say certain things, it can completely change the morning or the day because you've said, you know, something off. And it's your job as a caregiver to accommodate, to change your language. Yeah, so I guess just going back into this, you know, creating things for people with autism, it's realizing some of these patterns, right? So how do you make it easy for someone dealing with people who are different than you? How do you make it easy? And how do you make it so you can't get in trouble? And how do you make it so their life can go a bit smoother? Because it's kind of unfair.
I love what you said. I'm on the spectrum, high functioning. And I get triggered. Very seldom does it happen to me, but it happened yesterday, which is a weird coincidence that you're bringing it up today. And for me, it was probably 4 hours before I realized what had happened and how my behavior had changed over the last 4 hours. You know, once the trigger happened and the switch was on, it wasn't until the switch came off that I realized it had ever been on to start with. And you know, I struggle with it. And so in my household, we use code words. to tell you something that maybe you wouldn't want to publicly tell someone around strangers or some people who aren't close to you. And so we use Remington as a code word for, hey, Josh, you've told us all that story 10 times already. We don't need to hear it an 11th time. We use Mustang to be, hey, we're looking at your rear end. Your plumber's crack's not attractive. Please pull your pants up. And, you know, we have another one for trigger situations where you've been triggered and, you know, your behavior is different than normal. And for me, those code words, you know, are a way of telling me to sort of snap, to realize what's happening in a non-confrontational way that doesn't escalate the trigger situation, but lets me know, hey, you might want to just pause and maybe take a walk and catch your breath and recenter, and we'll come back to this conversation later. Mm-hmm. And then you add
COVID on top.
That's exactly right.
And then I found, you know, even for myself, like I'm more high functioning than on certain areas, but there's some areas like I found that I'm more triggered on.
Yeah, for sure. Me too.
Than I would have otherwise been. Even there's just like silly phrases. Like if somebody says something's impossible, I get really upset with that, even though it's just from their perspective and I shouldn't even react to that. But like right away, my brain goes into like, well, actually, how do you know this? And here's the 10 ways. And I just get into these loops and I think I have to explain it or write it out and nobody cares. And so I think there's been more triggers because of COVID that have at least been more apparent, or at least the reactions are stronger. But then that goes back to like, you know, when I look at how the world is set up, like from a technical perspective, that's just even more frustrating, right? So like I already have these different triggers. You already have these words and things that can kind of throw things off, or like schedule changes or certain alerts. But then brands are not really thinking through, as an example, context changes. Is a trigger in transitions. And so they might just send a text. Like I used a mail service recently and they sent this most cryptic text to say that it was being delivered. And I'm like, what the heck? Like I get so upset because I'm just thinking like, first, who are you? This thing looks like spam. I don't even know if this is real. You click it. Like it's now put me in this place because of a design decision and the way they wrote something that gets me in, that actually becomes a new trigger for me. Right. And I'm thinking, you know, probably not alone, right? And I think, and also I think there's a lot of people who are facing similar frustrations. Maybe they're not on the spectrum, you know, technically, but the same things that affect us maybe affect other people too, maybe just without the extreme reaction, but it still frustrates them, right? And so I think designing for people on the spectrum is like the canary in the coal mine.
No, for sure.
Right? Like you're, because of the fact that we have these extreme reactions, like I go from 0 to 100 in a split second.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
There's no in between. You actually can detect things that will just benefit everybody else, where maybe for them, they get to like, they go from 0 to 20, but they don't maybe get angry about it. Maybe they don't write a review about it, but they just vote with their wallet and go somewhere else, right? They just, you see.
Or maybe they don't normally do that, but because our anxiety is so high due to COVID and lockdowns and cybercrime and what's happening in Afghanistan and all the other things happening in the world right now, you know, you're already at an 80. So if you push that extra 20,
right? Actually, that's a good point.
You're at 100.
Yeah. Maybe they don't go from 0 to 100, but they go from 0 to 20, but because they're at 80, that's a very interesting idea. Yeah. So that's why I think designing for people who have these extreme reactions is just going to benefit everybody else, which means about, you know, speed, right? Like I have a very short attention span. So I'm pretty obsessed recently about making web experiences load in under half a second and keeping it there, because it is possible. And you can do entire applications with dynamic and static content loading in under half a second. That excites me because you couldn't do that a year ago. Just the tech didn't really allow you to break through that. Recently I had a project that it's consistently at 0.3 seconds load time. And that's exciting because I could never get it to that level. And that's with all kinds of stuff, pixels and different trackers and stuff. But it's just the way that you build, you can make you can extract those things that normally are just like lazy, like just funny. They say lazy loading and as a term today means make it so the browser loads things as you do it. But most of the web today was actually lazy coded, right? Like people just kind of jam code in there, little pixels. Oh, you want a little thing on the website? Great, let's throw it in there. not realizing the impact. And yes, Google's, you know, they'll penalize you now for having bad load times. What does it do to people? Like, at what point did we switch to prioritizing the systems versus the humans that use the stuff, right? And so if you actually were intentional at the way you loaded these things, you can get all the data you want, but still make the experience to the visitor half a second. You don't have to sacrifice the security and the stability or the dynamic stuff. Like, just do it better. And net result is, in working with this one company recently, it floored me what the effect it can have. First, the effect it had on me from being on the spectrum side of things, like just being comfortable with the speed, right? Which I don't know if I kind of walked you through the coding of the WaveDirect site, but if you go to like wavedirect.net, it was a project where I just wanted to see how far I could push certain stuff. But in there, just the way that it makes you feel is actually what's important. Like, that 0.3 seconds was important to make it just feel instantaneous, like just so instant as you kind of go through each of the different pages and stuff. And so I just think that's what everything should feel like, because then the technology just becomes invisible and people can get, you know, to where they want to go and they not feel hampered. They don't have to feel like they're waiting.
I love that. Tell us about WaveDirect. I don't think we've talked about that before.
So yeah, so WaveDirect is a project, started with them about a year ago as an advisor. They're an internet provider based in Ontario. They help farms and underserved communities get internet access, high-speed internet. So either through cable fiber or like beaming internet to the farms, so they can have 50 megabit per second internet. A world I wasn't actually very familiar with. I was like, I didn't even know this was a thing. But the more I got into just looking at them, they wanted to have a closer relationship with their customers. And then what I learned, though, what held them back, they wanted to use the technology that my previous company built. And I couldn't put them onto it because their data was so messy. And not their fault, but just the way that the system allowed things to be entered. There was duplicates, there was bad phone numbers, there was just stuff stuffed into notes. Company names in the last name field, which is actually a problem I'm seeing more and more is actually everywhere. It's not just unique to them, but it was really messy, and it was shocking to me that they were hampered on their ability to create close relationships with customers because nothing was standardized. Addresses were not standardized, phone numbers weren't standardized. Which is the same thing, even Salesforce, as I've poked further, I'm realizing that everybody has actually having this problem because nothing forces it in a certain universal format. And so it became really difficult to just, you know, you can't just hit Twilio as an example with it because it's not a standard phone number. And so, spent a few months working with them on redesigning their data. And I built a universal data model that, instead of thinking of it as, you know, contacts and accounts, we thought it's identities, persons, organization, locations, and then there's a way to map the relationships between them, and those relationships can be broken at any time. And by designing the data that way, it makes it future proof, so we can pump it into Salesforce or HubSpot or wherever we want and pull it out later and put it into some other system if we want, but it future proofs it, makes it more agile. So it was like, I liked the project because it was fun. Like, I was just, I this is kind of my sweet spot. Like, going back to like, what are you passionate about? Like, for me during COVID, it's stuff like this that just like, I get a kick out of building new ways to do things. And so I was frustrated that I couldn't just go and search for like, what's the best way to store this data? Like, how do I really make this completely future proof? And everyone has their own data schema. Like, Salesforce calls things a certain way, and then if they ever wanted to get ISO in the future, addresses have to be a certain way. So like, everyone has all these different standards, but like, there was no place I could go to like say, here's the schema design you should have. That was just surprising. So yeah, so help them design the data. And then what we learned from that, once we cleaned it up, we then said, okay, let's build a web experience based upon the data that we want. So let's actually design the data first.
Yeah.
The actual raw data. Like, everyone just looked at me like crazy. And actually, to this day, they're like, we had no idea what you were saying. But to me, it made sense. But I was like, let's actually design the data that you want to end up with. like the actual raw thing. And then we can figure out, okay, great. Then that means we can make these certain reports. And then from that, we then design the site from a visual perspective. But we actually designed, I call it like data interface design. They start with the data design, and then you do user interface design. And by doing that, it made this what normally would take years to do a transformation, we were able to do in a few months.
Well, that's fantastic.
This is just something I always was kind of wondering about, is like, if you actually design the data up front, does it actually matter? And I think it actually matters more than user interface design. The data and design has to be intentional, because interoperability doesn't just happen by accident. Someone might accidentally click a button, but data doesn't just accidentally work.
Well, it's certainly easier to redo your UI than it is to change out your data model.
Exactly. So yeah, it was a fun group. And the net result is, once the data was clean, we kind of redesigned the site. And that's where I started. I've been spending the last 3 years working on Gatsby and headless design, and building out a framework that gets consistently web experiences that are under half a second.
And is this what touchless does? Or,
I mean, like, the idea about touchless was originally just to be a lab, right? Just to try stuff. Because what I learned after retiring from Statflow is my passion was building in tech. I just kind of really love building stuff, you know. In a other life, I might just be a CTO. I was like, oh, I just love the building process and the engineering process, like, insanely. And I love data. From that, just like, okay, well, why don't I just do both those things, build and like build with data, and like, I love this headless stuff. And so that kind of got wrapped into touchless. And then it turns out a lot of people want both things, right? Because you can't get to the headless world without good data. Because headless, basically, to do headless design and to like run your website to be really efficiently, you need to have a really strong data layer behind it. And you have to convert all your content into like data objects. So you actually need data in order to do, you need the data design before you can do headless well. It's a huge barrier, I think, of why people haven't shifted as much as they should. Like, you have startups going the headless route, and you have people like PC Financial and certain banks are going there. But large companies struggle with moving in that direction because it's hard. It's a complete rethink in how you do web design.
Kevin, for the less technical people in the audience, what's headless?
Yeah, so headless is this idea where you can have your, think of it like WordPress. Like, if you go to a WordPress admin panel, you go someplace to like manage your content, you store it there. When you write your article and you hit the save button, that's data, right? You've just saved data somewhere. Headless says, we don't care where the data comes from. You could store it in WordPress, you could store it in a database, you could store it in Contentful, whatever. But you have a data source. Then the data source gets connected to a front end, which automatically can build and present your content by pulling the data from the data source. It can manifest itself in a few ways, right? But like, when you think of what is headless, right? Headless is about, you can have your, like, a headless content management system would be you logging into the WordPress panel, adding your content, and that's all you do there. You hit the save button and there's no head. There's no display. It extracts the display from the front end. And previously what you would do is you'd like install a theme into WordPress. And so you'd actually have your front end and your back end in the same system. Headless says, just be the bottom, right? Like you store your data and your content into a place, and you can swap out the head. So the benefit to that is you're not locked into whatever experience you sign up for on the front end, right? Like, you can, as you said, it's much easier under this model to swap your UI out. It is not easy if you had them all part of the same system. So you need to separate the back end from the front end. So if you think of the front end as head, think of the back end as the headless part. You end up with this very agile ability. So where I've learned with headless is that you also should make your interfaces bottomless. What that means is, I think that a good interface, preferably, should not care where the back end is. And so if you build your whole thing on the idea that it has to pull from WordPress, if you want to switch it out later, you've kind of just created the same problem you would have had if they were all part of the same thing. Like, the whole benefit of separating them out is don't create reliance, right? So your head should not have a bottom to it. It should not care what the bottom is, what the data layer is.
Yeah, I ran into this exact problem recently where one of my portfolio companies had spent the last few months working on a new version. And they got the back end done, but they were woefully understaffed on front-end developers. And when I talked to the team, I was frustrated because the way they built the back-end, it no longer worked with the current front-end, and we had no new front-end, so there was no way to experience the work that they'd done on the back-end for this new rev. And it was exactly the opposite of what you're saying. They were so tightly integrated that you couldn't improve one without changing the other. And it slowed things down tremendously, and it kind of forced them into a waterfall-esque release process.
Now you actually end up with the back end dictating everything to the front end. And guess what's going to happen once they've figured it work? They're going to have the same problem again in 6 months when they want to switch it out again.
Yeah.
And so, because what if you want to change the back end? Now your front end is going to be so tied to whatever they've done in the back end. Everyone struggles with this though. And so the idea of touchless, in order to enable both these worlds, right? If you fix the web experience to make it straightforward, accessible, and fast loading, you fix things for people with autism, especially if you pick the right words, right? Make it really clear. In order to enable that world, you need the data layer. But then the idea is that there needs to be this layer that just kind of allows those two things to run in isolation without one affecting the other or one requiring the other. And so that's the idea of touchless. So in the WaveDirect example, why I think that was a perfect project, they have an on-premise data layer that cannot change. And so I was able to move it into the cloud, build an API on top of it, integrate it into a whole web stack, and yet it's still their same system. They did not have to swap anything out. That, I think, is kind of the side, because it's like touch less of the, you know, I mean, you could play on that world a bunch of ways. But the idea is, like, you don't even have to touch it. Just include it. Work around it. And we found some ways to kind of make it all connected through Amazon, kind of migrate it to the cloud and replicate it and all that stuff. So there's options now to be able to make this work where you don't become so intertwined. And it was something that I just saw happen all the time at Staflow, where we would go it down a certain path, and then, you know, 2 years later want to change, and it's like, crap, you know, it's too late. We just put 100 people on this other way of doing things. So what we're focused on is building this universal data model called touchless data, where people subscribe to a schema that just works and it's universal. And so they don't have to build their business from scratch. So actually a new business, I think, starts with a schema. You can then connect into a CRM and all that stuff, but you actually start with a schema where it's tuned to be universal, right? A person is a person, you know, a name, a birth date, a death date, a couple other things, and that's a person.
It does.
it sounds cruel, but that's a person. And then you had, like, extract everything else out, right? A person doesn't have a phone number. Like, a person has a relationship with a phone number. A phone number is an identity. Just, you know, it's person with a phone number. And so starts with the data model, and then we have this enrichment layer where you connect your existing sources and standardize it into the model. And then there's a new thing we're launching called XO, which is the web platform we used with WaveDirect, and to make it so it's like, think of it like middleware. We don't really care what the back end is.
Sort of like a Zapier, I would think. Is that right? Or am I thinking
it's kind of just like a data middleware that just kind of makes it's like that. It's okay. If you swap out your back end, like if you go on Gatsby Cloud right now, you can like change, you can pick your back end. Problem is, it doesn't handle anything like migrations. Think of it like a middleware that just makes it, you know, so you can swap things out. And then it has a front end, which is it's a framework where people can customize it and, you know, do their own code on the front and make it their own in React. But so that's the XO platform. And then that connects to a live data layer through Rudderstack or other event-based system. And the whole vision of that, right, is that it's future-proofing business. So you're not stuck. Like, as these startups and people get going, they don't have to upgrade to the next thing and then retool everything and jam their older, like, do an export from QuickBooks, or do an export and jam it into NetSuite. Like, that process can be done easier if you stored your stuff in a clean middleware, a middle layer, and then it just gets pushed to those systems as you want them. And I think this is the next, you know, I think this is the next 100 years, right, is around making this world where you can swap things easier. And by doing all this, you can create really great front ends. But if we just kind of focused on the front end piece and didn't get into the data piece,
yeah,
we wouldn't be really solving the problem. So, you know, we're taking on a bunch by doing this, but the idea is you can future-proof the stack.
Are you going to offer them professional services as well, or just the product pieces to help with that?
We currently are doing like managed services to help folks do it, just because this, like, even if you gave people the building blocks for this, they don't really know what to do with it. I really struggled with it, to wrap my head around how to take what I know and put it into this model. And I would imagine anyone would have difficulty trying to understand how to do it. You see a lot of people put their stuff into these new technologies, but do it really poorly, right? And they'll think that they've won. Oh yeah, I transitioned to Gatsby or Next.js, but like they might only be using 1% of its potential. And it's like, no, like if you just did a little bit more, your Google ranking would triple. And so
yeah,
I think there's some of that. I mean, our goal would be to open source most of this, because I'm more interested in just, you know, I would love it if the whole world of tech was built for people on the spectrum. And so I can't do it doing services work, right? So we used to do some hourly stuff, but we've eliminated that and made it all SaaS, with the idea that I think basically a lot of agencies, a lot of people who are in this space could be doing the same, right? Just kind of taking some of what, even whether it's just best practices, whatever, like we'll be giving away a bunch of this stuff too. But I think just making it easier for people to build great experiences will be pretty satisfying.
If people want to learn more, Kevin, where would they go?
Nowhere today.
Nowhere.
They can... We'll tell you. No, we're just being very careful, right, as to like when you'll see some releases as we talk about what we're doing in auto. And the way that we're going about this is basically launch concept cars. Think of it like, basically like, think of WaveDirect as like a concept car. It's like showing off, okay, here's what the Tesla Plaid looks like. Where you go from zero to, because people before would think, oh, it's impossible to get something loading in less than a second or less than 0.7 seconds. So this was like, these are like little, you know, proof points of what does it look like when things are fast. And then, you know, we'll be able to launch more as we go. But we're trying to be very careful that we don't take on more than we want. I think our next play locally is to help small businesses with this tech, because the cool thing about this whole thing is it's basically free. And so there's no infrastructure, there's no server. That's really helpful if you're a startup, or if you're somebody who's a small business who, instead of taking on risks of hiring a web designer, we might actually just make this available for free to a bunch of small businesses. We have an internal goal of how many we'd like to launch proactively for people. Even if they don't ask, we'll give them a site. But I think, yeah, we're figuring out where this can be useful, right? And what scenarios, who should kind of benefit from it? Because I think the last thing we want to do is sell this to just like large enterprise. I think we want to make this like the people who really need this are the startups and the people who are just starting out. Right.
Or even in the enterprise, if it's a new business initiative or a new build within a large organization, right? Because you have to start.
Well, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I just think the real opportunity, like the problem with that, right, is if we take on a whole bunch of large enterprise transformations, what's the effect that we're going to have? How many businesses will we affect by doing that, right? Them and maybe their business unit. But it's this technology everybody needs, right? Not 10 accounts, not 20 accounts. So I think this is more just a philosophical thing that we're thinking about, like where I think the people who need it are mid-market and SMBs and maybe the ones that are less than, you know, 10,000 employees or 1,000 employees. Those are the ones that really crave agility, but maybe don't have the resources to do it. Whereas a large company, you know, they'll get by. The biggest learning out of all this, which is beyond just the fact that it's just cool stuff, is it takes over Google rankings because of the new Core Vitals update that just launched this year. This is the biggest change in the Google algorithm in 10 years, I'd say. Page speed, performance, accessibility are more important than ever. And what we found with WaveDirect is we outrank large companies that have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on their web experience. We outrank them on some very competitive keywords just because of the fact that we're accessible and highly performant. So it'll be interesting to see, right? It's still early days to kind of see the impact of it. But Yeah. So I guess going back to like, it just goes back to the earlier part of the conversation is if you can design for somebody on the spectrum, everybody benefits. But there are business outcomes that can come from designing for people with short attention spans or people who get frustrated easily and people who react strongly. If more people did it, I think we would have a less frustrating world of tech.
This is one more example of how investing in diversity, diversity of thought, diversity of character, can really drive positive results for your organization. We've seen it sort of in DEI initiatives over the last year. We've seen that boards with women on them typically are, you know, those companies perform higher than companies with all male boards, for example. We're seeing many benefits of this. I loved it to see the fact that now, as you mentioned with Google, they're leaning heavily on accessibility as one other way to think about diversity. And the fact that you're deciding to invest your time and effort in this is commendable and very interesting. I really didn't know what you guys were doing over there.
Yeah, we're just still starting out and we're trying to be careful. I mean, I think one of our other learnings is, you know, once you have a bunch of cash, you'd like to spend it. So
yeah,
I would like to see the, you know, the product and certain stuff, you know, farther along. But what's cool is, you know, in the last 2 weeks alone, we have a pipeline now of about 25 accounts, all of which are quite lucrative.
That's great.
But we can only take on a couple. so we're just, you know, I think this is the issue of, I guess the founder's dilemma, right? Is like, it's very tempting to just say, let's sign them all up. But the reality is it's better to kind of know who you are and what you're trying to go for and be very focused on that, because the worst thing that can happen actually is to have success so fast that you forget where you're going, right?
Yeah.
And the nice thing is I'm doing this with my brother. So, you know, he's working with me and it's something we can actually do together. So he's a pivotal part of what we're up to. So I think, I'm excited. I'm excited kind of around this idea of like being true to the core. And I don't think I would have done this had COVID not happened. I wouldn't have had this opportunity to reflect and reset. I would have just still been jet setting and all kinds of stuff. So it's been a good reset.
Well, that's awesome, Kevin.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a stellar update, man. We're out of time, but as usual, we could have talked for 3 hours in a 1 hour time slot. Kevin, it's been great catching up. I really appreciate you sharing this with us. I think the audience will love it. And let's catch up again in a couple of quarters and see where you and Touchless are.
Yeah, sounds good. I appreciate it. Good to catch up.
Great, my friend. Thank you so much. That's it, everyone, and thank you for joining Capital Geek. Subscribe via Apple, Stitcher, or any platform where you usually find fantastic podcasts. Tune in again soon for another great episode of Capital Geek.